All right, I think we're going to begin. The live stream on Facebook is not working, but that's all right. So we'll begin anyway. Okay, so we are recording it. If anyone wants it afterwards, share with you afterwards. Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the series of Shmooze with my father about interesting and thought-provoking topics. So, as we always do, if you have any questions or comments or ideas that you want to share throughout this, please don't hesitate. The best way to do that is to either put it on the public chat or to private message me, and then you can become part of this very important conversation. So, the topic of tonight is about alcohol. A very important topic, very relevant topic. And we're going to try and discuss this in a sort of nuanced and detailed way about the pros, the cons, perhaps a few practical ideas, what shuls can do, what shuls should be doing, what aren't they doing. Now, as we always start off saying, we're not talking about anything specific or anyone specific, obviously. This is a general discussion. This is a worldwide issue. This is not a Sydney issue, any specific shul issue. I think it's fair to say that this is quite a common issue. So let's get right into it. And again, if you have anything to say, please interrupt us through the comments and participate in the conversation. So let's start with, let me ask you, it's obvious that alcohol could be dangerous. It's a risky thing. It has definitely downsides to it. So let's start with that. People always say, let's start on a positive note. Let's start on a negative note and discuss what actually are the dangers of alcohol? What are the downsides to alcohol?
So first of all, good to be with everyone again. A new term, lots of things happening in this term, so stay tuned. I can also just add, Rabbi Levi said before, people should ask questions and put in the chat and so on. This is a topic with lots of different perspectives, so please feel free to disagree. In fact, it would make it much more exciting if you did disagree. So please don't hold back. If you want to say something or disagree along the way or ask a question, please put it in the chat or a private message him. So I think we know that indulgence in any physical pleasure could be a problem, right? We are people that live for meaning and purpose. We are people that try to live our lives in a healthy and balanced way. So therefore, there's nothing wrong in enjoying God's will, but at the same time, we shouldn't really overindulge in any physical pleasure. Self-control is a good thing always. But I think the specific danger with something like alcohol is something very different. First of all, we know it's an addictive thing. It can be very addictive. Alcoholism is a problem. And there are plenty of people that do become addicted to alcohol. You'll remember just a few weeks ago, me and you were in a car and we drove down Bondi Road and we had to stop and call an ambulance for someone that was completely under the influence in the Waverley Park. He was completely have lost everything, and that's very, very sad. It was very hard to see that. So addictiveness is a problem. There are certain behaviors in life that are more addictive than others. And if someone is prone to addiction, I'm not a psychologist or a therapist, and therefore not really qualified to give a proper analysis on this, but if something is prone to be more addictive, then it becomes a problem because addiction in itself is a very destructive force. But even before coming addicted, we know the Gemara says that there are three things that Hashem, the three people that Hashem, that Hashem loves. One is someone who doesn't lose his temper, someone that can take offense from other people and doesn't say anything. It's called Ma'avir al Midosov, and someone that doesn't get completely drunk. Because one of the things with getting completely drunk is that it's loss of control. And as human beings, as Jews specifically, we are supposed to be always in control. That's part of how we live. We're in control of ourselves, in control of our emotions, in control of our actions, and loss of control is a bad thing. And of course, the simple thing is that it leads to, I mean, it's not healthy in excess and so on, and also it's dangerous. People can do things that are dangerous. They can be violent. They can do things that are dangerous. I think the dangers are fairly obvious, and the differences between alcohol and, let's say, another normal physical pleasure like food or something like that is fairly apparent.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that. I mean, food is also abused many times. You know, people could.
Sure, sure.
But it's probably fair to say that alcohol is definitely abused more than food is, and on a sort of more common basis. It's probably true to say. Someone here, Paul's asked, well, what are the pros? I can think of the cons. Yeah, that's, we are definitely going to get to the pros. Definitely part of the discussion, but I thought it would be good to sort of lay out very clearly what the dangers are about alcohol. So let's start with this. Before we get to the pros and sort of the benefits that can come from drinking alcohol, if there's something that's so dangerous, and we know it's dangerous. I mean, I know, you know, if you've ever walked in the street on Friday night or Saturday night, and you see what goes on in some places. I mean, it's shocking. You know, people are beating each other up, screaming at each other. I mean, the downsides are obvious. So why not ban it? I guess that's a general question on a societal level. Like, you know, why doesn't the government ban alcohol? But we're not in the government, so we're not going to ask that question. I guess the question is more in terms of Schultz. You know, if it's a destructive thing, why have it? Let's just ban it completely.
So, yeah, I mean, so your question wasn't about the benefits of alcohol and if there are or there aren't, but let's just talk about the concept of banning in general, right? Again, I'm not, first of all, as we'll see later, and I think maybe we'll discuss this a little bit soon, but I mean, alcohol in some form of moderation certainly has a place in Yiddishkeit. I mean, we make Kiddush and we drink four cups of wine on Pesach night and so on and so forth. But besides that, the reality is that it's part of society. It's part of the social fabric of society. So yes, we could ban it. We could ban it in our own families. We can say never have alcohol. We can say in schools never have alcohol, and in any public institution, and so on and so forth. But it calls into question the concept of banning altogether. Is banning something effective? Okay. Again, before we discuss if there is any benefits or not, but generally banning something is problematic in its own right. I'll give you a line that I love. I love the line from Dr. Pelkovitz. Dr. Pelkovitz has a number of lectures. And he has a whole paper written on how to train children to use the internet safely, right? Now, we know there are communities that exist in the world, not many. There are communities that choose a path of what he calls isolation. In other words, they isolate themselves from the rest of the world, and they don't let any form of technology or internet into their family life, into their school life, into the community life, and so on and so forth. His argument is, and I think I certainly subscribe to this, his argument is, it doesn't really work because it's very, very hard to isolate people. Bringing up children, it's very, very hard, to isolate people from something that is so part of society and so part of the social fabric of society. And therefore, he talks about the concept of isolation versus inoculation. In other words, if something is, now, not everything is
that's
good.
That's very fancy English. Can you translate those?
Yeah, sure. So inoculate means like immunize. In other words, like, so isolate means you choose a path where you just stay, you keep people away from it. The reality is, however, that what happens with that is that if you do that, people never learn to use something in a safe way. So, for example, the reality is that those communities that, for example, keep their kids and keep the whole community away from internet are running a very, very big risk. It might work for some of them, and probably does. And probably they have a very calm and beautiful life, completely safe and protected from the distractions of the internet. However, the reality is, number one, internet has a lot of good stuff. But besides the good stuff, it's part of it. I mean, you can't open a bank account. You can't buy anything. Everything's there on internet, right? So what happens is, if you don't inoculate, otherwise you don't actually train families and train young children and train people or students or older people, society in general, if the community isn't exposed and it's not exposed to the discussion of how, yes, to use it, but to use it in a safe way, the risk afterwards of people being exposed to it and not having the tools to do it safely and then running the risk of using it in a very abused and destructive way is a very, very high risk. The notion of banning something that is so part of society that could be used in a safe way and it could be used in a sort of an innocent way, before we get to any spiritual or beneficial way, but even if we just use it in an innocent way, the dangers of banning something completely that could be used in a safe way or innocent way, I think is very, very problematic.
Do you think, even on a practical level, you think it's possible to ban things? I mean, besides the fact, is there, you know, is it even effective? Does it even
I don't think so, especially if you live in a society, especially if you live in a place like Sydney or let's say, where it's all around you. I mean, if you bring up, let's say a Jewish family has children and in your home, you never ever have a drop of alcohol. So you only make kiddush and grape juice and you never have a chayim, nothing, right? And let's say the shul you attend does the same thing. It's not going to work. I mean, the kid goes to school. There's other kids that are exposed to alcohol. There are discussions of alcohol. He reads alcohol in the media. There are bars all around. I mean, Sydney's full of bars. They couldn't even control themselves during coronavirus. I mean, some of them are getting fines because they don't know how to socially distance. I mean, they're just the culture is so much around alcohol. So you can ban it completely, which means it'll never be talked about and never be discussed. And then what will happen is eventually they'll be exposed to it and use it in a very dangerous way. Very, very, it's very, very probable that will happen.
Mm. So I guess that leads us to the next question. And once again, if anyone has anything to say, please jump in here in the comments, which is, you know, in Judaism, we ban a lot of things, right? Even though it's very rampant. So for example, when I was growing up, and I'm sure probably everyone else here, pig was banned from our house. You know, bacon and eggs is quite a common breakfast. It's part of the culture. But we still banned it, right? In other words, it was bad, and I guess, you know, every Jewish home is obviously different levels of observance, etc., but is banned from something, right? So I guess the question is, what I'm leading to is, obviously, alcohol is not 100% what we would say in sort of Jewish expression, treif. In other words, obviously, if we would say that it's 100% bad, we wouldn't care that it's rampant in society. We would just say, tough luck, you know, it's forbidden. It's bad, right? But obviously, it is. If you're saying that we shouldn't ban it, obviously there is some level of good to it, or maybe very good to it. So, in other words, based on what we said before, how dangerous it is, and how you know it can bring terrible things, which is obvious. We don't even need to discuss that. Why not treat it like chazer? Why not treat it like technology on Shabbat, for example, right? You know, it could be very hard to live without technology, but the fact is we do it every week, right? So why not treat it like that?
That's a very good question. And I think the answer to that question is in the question itself. The very fact that certain things are treif, so to speak, and certain things aren't is already telling. In other words, like this. As Jews, we have a moral code and we have a system of absolute morality versus immorality and so on and so forth. And we have a guide, the Torah, that tells us certain things are just completely out of, that's it. You can't do it. And once, if you subscribe to that belief in Torah and Torah Misina and so on and so forth, then that becomes very easy. So we know that it's not good for us. It's an absolute. It has no redeeming factor. The very fact that the Torah rejects it out completely means, and we know this from Jewish literature, mysticism and so on and forth, that's what it means. The things that are forbidden actually means that they cannot be used for good. They cannot be elevated. So therefore, chazer, pig, whatever, or treif, whatever, are things that cannot be used for good, and therefore they need to be completely out of bounds. And that's how we live our life. And we build that spiritual, symbolic, divine wall around us where it's just not going to happen. And that in itself provides the ultimate protection that we know we'll never, or hopefully we'll never engage in it. However, if the Torah itself doesn't ban something, often what that means is that thing could be used for the good. Now, that is true with all food, for example, and all physical things which are neutral. I mean, eating, let's just take food, for example, right, before we get to alcohol. So we know that, you know, if we would explore this in Jewish thinking, the way it works is as follows. So there's three levels of eating. There's when you eat something that is wrong, God forbid you eat on Yom Kippur, or you eat something that's not kosher, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just clearly, according to the Torah, a wrong thing to do. Then there's neutral eating. When you eat, you eat in a healthy way, not any, no particular holiness to it. It's just sort of, you know, within, you're not being particularly gluttonous or overindulgent, just eating normally, and that's not particularly holy, it's not particularly unholy, right? And then there's a concept which we know very, very clearly from Jewish thought, that actually the things that are neutral need to be done actually in a special way. The ideal is not to just eat neutrally, but actually to elevate it, so to make a bracha before, to eat it for the right reason, to eat it in order to be strong to serve Hashem, and so on and so forth. So that is true with everything. Now, it's particularly true with alcohol, because alcohol is not just that it's not treif. In other words, we're talking about obviously kosher alcohol now, right? There are alcohol that is treif, by the way, right?
That's a separate shear.
Yeah, but exactly. And how? Which ones are? Yeah, but when we talk about something as alcohol, the very fact that the Torah doesn't make a treif obviously means that it has some sort of place. And not only that, when it comes to alcohol, it clearly has a place. Now let's try and unpack that a little bit, right? And needs to be, I think, and this needs to be properly understood. And I'm going to spend a few minutes on this, if that's okay, because this is something which is really, really important to understand. Generally, right? No, let's start differently. Torah, alcohol, wine, for example, or what the Gemara refers to, the Talmud refers to as chamar de Medina, the alcoholic beverage of the time, so to speak, has a place in Jewish law in a very significant way. We have halacha, we have a mitzvah like Kiddush. And let me just enlighten everyone that Kiddush, in times of the Talmud, was hardly ever made on grape juice. Now, it doesn't mean it can't be made on grape juice, but standard practice was never to make Kiddush on grape juice, it was made on wine. They used to dilute the wine a little bit with water, but it was an alcoholic beverage, right? Kiddush. Every time you bench, according to the Talmud, ideally you should do it over a cup of wine. Pesach night, four cups of wine. For the whole, each person in the family is supposed to drink four cups of wine. If you look in the tractate of Brachot, you'll see that every wedding, every meal, very often meals would have more than one cup of wine. They'd have a cup of wine at the beginning, a cup of wine at the end, then they would bench and drink wine after the benching, right? So it obviously has a thing. We know that there's a pasuk, there's a verse that tells us, Yain yisamach levav enosh, that wine makes a person glad, makes a person happy, and it's not in a negative sense. It's talking about a positive sense, right? So we do find that there's this concept, and it's a separate discussion about what the idea is. There's many, many things about wine. Wine it symbolizes the concept of revealing. I mean, Purim is a mitzvah to drink, almost, right? Not a mitzvah to go crazy. It's a mitzvah to drink more than normal, and so on and so forth. So what is that? So that tells us that if done right, there is some room for it, and it could have benefits as well. Now let's understand that. First of all, like this, and I'm going to ask people just to have patience here, to listen carefully, because I think it needs to be done properly, step by step.
And we'll take questions. You don't have to. If you posted a question, we'll definitely read it and we'll discuss it.
Because I know what's on people's minds, that there are places and there are communities where alcohol is administered very irresponsibly. And that is and that is absolutely true. And that's not what I'm talking about. So let's discuss in the ideal world what is the ideal, what is the way to use alcohol in a Jewish sense. So first of all, we have this concept of kiddush, benching, arbakosis, wine, bris. By the way, many halachic opinions hold that it's definitely preferable, although one could do it on grape juice, it's preferable to do it on wine. Then there's the concept where sometimes a little innocent drink, a social thing where people get together and say a little l'chaim, wish each other good. It's innocent, it could be even beneficial. Now, the Gemara tells us, it's an interesting Gemara actually, the Talmud tells us, G'doylo legimo shemekarebes, that when people get together and there's a bit of food and a bit of drink, actually the Gemara says they can have either benefit. It can either bring people together or it can bring actually people, it can distance people from one another. Now, you can see this with alcohol very, very clearly. Very often, alcohol actually drives people away from each other. In other words, what happens is people get into themselves, they get wild, you know. They say, Nichnas yayin yetzes sod, when wine comes in, the secrets come out. Now, that in itself is a scary thing. It all depends what your secrets are. It all depends what your inner essence is. It depends where your focus is, right? We also find this concept where we have amongst Hasidic circles, we have this concept of Fabringen, which, by the way, is sometimes a very misunderstood concept, but let's tackle it head on. I don't like avoiding issues, right? A true Fabringen means like this, where people get together for the sole purpose of inspiring each other. Often the system is that one person talks and people sing, or people talk with each other, they discuss, they open up with each other. And sometimes in such a setting, and I know when I was in yeshiva, our mashpim, our rabbis used to sometimes lead a farbrengen. Number one, there was some l'chaim. People would say l'chaim with each other to connect and to bond with each other. The person leading the farbrengen would often take a little bit more than just everyone else took. And the results were fascinating. Often they would let their guard down, and with the great rabbis, I'm talking about the ones I had, including your grandfather, my father-in-law, who was my teacher in yeshiva, when he took a bit of l'chaim, the brilliance and the emotion and the feelings and the unbelievable depth that came out was amazing. It was truly amazing. It actually shaped our whole worldview in a way, right? Things which he wouldn't always open up with, in a context of a brain with a little bit of l'chaim, in other words, like this. Alcohol in Judaism is never a goal in itself. Okay, that's the important part to understand. It's never an end into itself. Drinking alcohol for the sake of pleasure or for the sake of just getting happy, that's a negative alcohol thing. Has no place in Judaism, actually, right? However, if alcohol is used sometimes as a tool to bring people together, to say l'chaim, when people bless each other over a little bit of l'chaim, over a little schnapps, let's say, right? Or they have a thing where they take one or two more l'chaims and they just loosen up a little bit and they bond with each other in a greater way, where the focus is very controlled, where the whole purpose is becoming closer to God, right? I mean, you've seen farbrengens like that. You grew up, you've seen gatherings like that, where, or on Simchas Torah, on Purim, people say a little bit extra l'chaim, and what it leads to, the test is always what it leads to. If it leads to more intense dancing, but dancing with the focus on the Torah, dancing with the focus becoming closer to God, right? Then it has tremendous benefits, and it always has. It's been a practice from many, many, many generations. People do it in a very controlled way, in a way where we don't lose complete control, and in a way where always the focus on Torah and mitzvahs is not weakened, but deepened, right? That's the test. If it's weakened, then you didn't do it right, and you shouldn't do it at all then. Right now, if it's done like that, if that's the focus, if the purpose of getting together is to retrieve true joy, when I say joy, focused joy, even Simchas Torah, you know, some people make a mistake and I think that Simchas Torah is a time to make yourself crazy. It's like a license. Purim and Simchas Torah, some people think that it's a license to lose control or a license to be happy in a very mundane way, to sort of lose, you know, be crazy. You know, that's not what it is at all. On Simchas Torah, for example, with all the dancing and all the happiness, you know what the test is when you after the dancing, when you say Aleinu at the end of davening, or you have to bench at the end of the meal, and you do it properly, and you do it even more properly because of the happiness. Now, the happiness brought you to a strengthening of Yiddishkeit, or a strengthening of bonding between each other, and people were able, because of the happiness, or by a wedding, because of making the chasen kala happy, were able to open up more and open up with each other and be more honest with each other, and so on and so forth, then it has a good thing. Now, I'm not making this up. This is something that we read in Svarim. This is something that we have seen by great people, great rabbanim, great tzaddikim, and so on and so forth. But that is if it is used in that particular context. So it does have positives, and it has a role, and the Gemara, the Talmud is full of it. I mean, Talmud is full of when people used to say drink alcohol by weddings for the purpose of making greater happiness. There's a pasuk which says that sometimes it brings out the inner essence of a person. If that's the focus, if a person's inner essence is meaning and purpose, then the little l'chaim or the two l'chaims or the three l'chaims will bring it out even more, right? As long as it's done in a healthy way. Where it becomes a problem is two things. First of all, what becomes a problem is if it leads to a completely lack of focus, where it leads to weakening the focus on Judaism and Torah mitzvahs, and also if the alcohol becomes the end in itself. So I don't know if anyone asked this yet, but I'm sure people have Kiddush Club on their minds, right?
Yeah.
Is that one of the questions?
Yeah, can I just interrupt you? Because you'll probably get to this later also as well. Sort of just to, if I can just sort of summarize what you just said, and you know, I guess what you've been saying is that if that alcohol is dangerous, that we established at the beginning, there are dangers to it, and if it is used, it needs to be used very, very properly in an extremely focused setting. I just want to add one thing to what you said, not at all, just to sort of just maybe to bring an example, just a personal example. I'm not sure if people experience what you're talking about necessarily. So sort of just to give an example of such a thing. I'll actually just bring two examples. You mentioned Zaidi before, my grandfather, Olav Shalom. Just to give you a little bit of description of what type of person he was before alcohol. He was somebody who never stopped learning Torah. He was somebody who literally, I never saw him without a sefer, without a Torah book. He knew everything in Torah. He was a person which knew the whole Gemara, the whole Chassidus. I mean, he was what we call a goyin, a true Torah genius, a true Torah giant in his time. And he was obviously a very great Chassid as well. And part of that was he would lead Fabrengens. He would lead Chassidic gatherings where he would take quite a bit of L'chaim, actually. I mean, he would drink a significant amount. I was by many of those. You know, we happen to have just been talking about one just the other day. I was once by the Rebbe's grave, by the oil for Gimel Tammuz, which is the Rebbe's yard site, the day of the Rebbe's passing. And the way it fell out that year was Shabbos, was Erev Gimel Tammuz. So we spent the whole Shabbos there. And it was a really spiritually uplifting experience. And I remember, I probably was 15 years old at the time. So we're talking about quite a long time ago. Not that long, but it's still quite a long. It's getting longer ago, unfortunately. And I just remember sitting with them a whole day, literally for like 7 hours. And the Torah, the depth, the memories that he shared. I mean, he was, after a lot of L'chaim, no one was wild, no one was screaming, no one was, it was such focus. It was like, and he shared a memory that he experienced with his Rebbe many years ago, and he was crying, and just the depth of the experience that came out because of it, I'll never forget it as long as I live. It was truly an inspirational experience, and it was done with such focus and unbelievable. And I think, you know, that's, unfortunately, as you sort of briefly mentioned, unfortunately, the idea of a Fabrengen is misused. That's the unfortunate truth. But I think, as you said, you know, if it's done right, it's done right. And another sort of dispersal, again, you know, we're not talking about any shuls in particular. One shul we can talk about is Bina, I think, because that's our shul. So
yes, you're going to finish.
But I'll let you talk about Bina, actually. I just want to read someone's question. Maybe that will lead into what you're about to say here. I think this is relevant to what we're about to talk about. The question was, well, one person asked, will Bina ever have a Kiddush club? So that's one question.
Okay.
I can assume what the answer will be, but I don't know. And Paul asked like this, I'll just read his whole question. It's a brilliant question. If alcohol is not banned from shuls, whose responsibility is it to ensure it is, I'm sorry, my English is not that good, used responsibly at shul? As a parent, you have the ability to control the message and how your children are exposed to alcohol, agreeing that total ban can be counterproductive, but you generally, as a congregant, don't have that ability at shul. So if you go to a shul and people are drinking alcohol every Shabbos at a Kiddush and just gets wild, or Simchas Torah and it just gets out of hand, or Purim just gets out of hand, and people, you know, just no one, and no one has any idea what's flying in the shul, you know, what kind of message is that to your children? I think that's a brilliant
question. Okay, brilliant question. So I think that's a good time. So let's talk about Bina.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you know what the fascinating thing is, before I talk about Bina, you know what the fascinating thing is, you just described the Fabrengen that you sat when you were 15 years old, which means you were underage. Okay. Yeah. And you were exposed to someone saying L'chaim, right? And to the best of my knowledge, you didn't become an alcoholic. And you don't, until today, you don't abuse, right? Because sometimes when you witness something being used right, it's also a lesson, even though you might be too young for it. But let me start by making the message very clear. So I'll start with the first question. Will Bina ever have a Kiddush club? So at Bina, everyone knows my line on that. And the answer is absolutely not. If a Kiddush club ever started, I would shut it down right away.
You just define what a Kiddush club is before we...
The Kiddush club is something, some ridiculous animal that started now in different shuls all over the world, where people take a break in the middle of davening. I don't know, like instead of listening to the haftarah, they'll like a bunch of people go out into a room and drink quite significant amounts of alcohol and make Kiddush because they can't wait till after davening, and they miss either the rabbi's drosha or the haftarah. Now, in Bina, it will never happen during the rabbi's drosha because the rabbi doesn't give a drosha, but it can happen to the haftarah during Knesset Torah. So the answer is a Bina will never happen because I would shut it down right away. And I always tell people, just to make it very clear, that if it ever started and I didn't have the control to shut it down, I would shut down the whole shul. because right, that's my answer about Kiddush Club. So I know we've worked very hard on this, and I know it's a small shul, but maybe I can't tell you what's happening in other shuls, and I can't tell you, but we do have a huge responsibility, and I think as people who go to shuls as congregants, but also as rabbis of shuls, or boards of shuls, or leadership, any form of leadership, we have a tremendous responsibility in the shul. The reason is this. Because if we let alcohol get out of control in any way in a shul, what I mean out of control is the following. Either it gets out of control, doesn't matter if it's Simchas Torah or Purim, whatever it is, or there becomes a culture of alcohol. Okay, now that's a very important word.
Mm.
Alcohol should never, ever become a culture. If it's used correctly, it's used as a supporting tool to something else. It's not a culture, right? So a Kiddush club is evil on so many levels. First of all, it cannot be with the right focus if you can't wait till the end of davening to make Kiddush and you're desperate halfway during davening because you need a drink, there's something wrong with you. What you need is not a shul, you need a psychologist or something to deal with your addiction. I don't know exactly what you need, right? Second of all, what it does is it creates a terrible message that drinking alcohol is more important than listening to the Haftarah or listening to the reading of the Torah, whatever the case is, right? And what it does is that's exactly what creates a culture of alcohol, right? The other thing that creates a culture of alcohol, for example, is when you have a kiddushim in shul and there's huge amounts of alcohol and there's people pushing people to say alcohol, right? You know, we've done this, we've talked about this many times at Bina, we have a rule. Even when we have it for bringing, and even if it's Simchas Torah, even if it's Purim, we don't harass people to say l'chaim. First of all, you should know that many people are in recovery. Right.
That's actually not a joke, by the way. I'll just interrupt you for a moment. I personally know someone who's an alcoholic, a great guy, and a lot of them
who was alcoholic,
I should say. Well, he would call himself a recovering alcoholic, an amazing person, someone who literally worked on themselves and transformed their life. Really, really an amazing person. And I know that I've offered him l'chaim in the past, not knowing that he was an alcoholic, and he told me clearly, I'm not. And obviously, I never offered him again because such people, they really want to say l'chaim, and if they would, that would literally destroy the life in a moment. That can actually, it can turn over their whole life. And
correct.
Although I will say, I actually attended his birthday party, and he offered me l'chaim. So, which is, I'm not sure all alcoholics agree, but he's obviously of the opinion that, you know, he's obviously dealing with a problem, and he's dealing with it in an amazing way, but it's not necessarily for everyone, and he doesn't necessarily...
I've heard that from a number of recovering alcoholics, that they actually maintain that shul should not ban alcohol. But they should do it right, and they should educate people how to do it right, and they should just not create a culture. For example, another way of creating a culture of alcohol is when sometimes, and I'm not pinpointing anyone, I'm not blaming anyone, that's not the point. But you do, I'm talking about things I saw from overseas institutions, okay? So it's always easier. So when you see sometimes when people advertise events, and the advertisement is all about alcohol, in other words, it's come drink or something, right?
Or Purim open bar.
Yeah, it sounds like a Purim open bar. So a stir open bar. That's creating a culture of alcohol. That's very, very bad. So getting back to Bina, you know that I'll tell you a little story, right? I'll tell you two things, first of all, right? One negative, one positive. So at the very, very beginning of Bina, when we started the whole Simchas Torah thing, we right away got, even on Simchas Torah, very, very much under control. And I'll never forget the story. And it happened a number of times in the early years. It doesn't happen anymore for a reason which will become obvious in a moment. Where in the middle of our kofes, there are people that go from one shul to another. And we had a bunch of kids, high school kids, long as gone, these are people, adults already today, who dropped in, very quickly saw, in fact, now if it ever happens, thank God we have a culture at Bina that if anyone walks in who's underage, there's like seven people all looking at the bottle to make sure it doesn't move, right? So they know. And people stopped coming after a while. We weren't one of these shuls that were lucky enough to get visitors during our kafes because people knew it's pretty boring there. That's not to say people don't say l'chaim. You know,
it's
that I'm
not boring in terms of people dance. It's boring in terms of the amount of...
The Levitikai is fantastic. People do say l'chaim. Thank God we reached the thing that no one ever gets out of control. But we do say l'chaim. I follow the minhag. I make kiddush on whiskey on Simchas Torah. And to the best of my knowledge, I've never gotten out of control, right? Because whatever, you do it in a controlled way. And on the other hand, the little bit of the chayim that we do say breaks down the barriers. It does create a joy, create a simcha. We have lots of fabrings during sukkahs or sometimes on Shabbos. And I will tell you, for example, and you know this, maybe other people here also know it, that we have a culture, for example, we have a minhag at Bina, that every simchas, every shmini atzeres simchas Torah, we have a fabring and we go around the table And we push people to grow in the Yiddishkeit. Now, people take upon resolutions, beautiful stuff, amazing stuff. People take upon themselves things that they're going to do in the coming year. And sometimes, you know, I push people in certain directions and I make them take the next step. And I can tell you, it's happened to me many, many times that sometimes I'm in two minds. Should I push them? Should I not push them? Are they going to be offended? Not going to be offended. And you know what? One or two little l'chaims, and I warm up and they warm up. They have a l'chaim, I have a l'chaim, and I go for it. And say, it's time you, putting on tefillin. It's time you started coming to shul once a week. Okay, and it works. And it's all about furthering Yiddishkeit. And we know that we very, very makbid, that even in the middle of our kofas, if it's very, very lebedig, but time comes to daven musaf or to say oleinu, that it should be absolutely quiet and it should be with absolute focus, right? So I'm saying that only because I'm not trying to promote Bina as a shul right now, because really we can't fit anyone in anyways because of the COVID restrictions. So this is not an advertisement, right? So please don't come to Shabbos because we're full. but when COVID finishes, that's a different story. But what I am saying is that what I've seen and the experience that we both have worked on together with others is that it is possible. Not as possible, it's absolutely imperative. It is possible to have a culture where you do use alcohol, where we say l'chaim once in a while, but it's done right, it's done safe, and it's done in a way where it enhances our connection to Hashem, and not God forbid weakens it. It strengthens it and doesn't weaken it.
And I must say, I obviously grew up in, I mean, I was been a starter when I was probably, I don't know, 7 years old. And it's been a journey. I'm sure at the beginning it wasn't perfect, and it's trial and error. And I think it was a goal of yours. It was like something that we're going to do. And I think, you know.
And I have had, I must tell you,
we're nervous about it, and we have to, you know, sort of, you know, we always try to be very, very. And I think it's good to be nervous about it. I think it's good to be on guard. I think it's a.
And I have to say that during the years at Bina, I've had on the occasion people come up to me who have witnessed misuse of alcohol in other institutions or other places or other cultures or in their own family having a problem, whatever the case is. And they ask me, why can't you just ban it? Why do you need it? Why does it have to be? And my answer is, I don't want to ban it because I don't think banning is effective. And I believe that if something has a benefit and if something has a place from the perspective of Torah and perspective of Yiddishkeit, I don't want to ban it. I actually want to use it properly. Just like I don't want to ban internet. Internet is something which is used, first of all, it's not effective to ban it, but even if I had the means to do it, right? From a very young age, I think we need to teach children. It's a whole other discussion how you do that. How to use the internet safely. Take something like internet, for example. It is amazingly beneficial. The fact that we have 15 people listening to a discussion now is because of the internet. The fact that when COVID came, we were able to take a whole learning program on Zoom is only because of the internet. The fact that people can access information and learning to an unbelievable level today is incredibly beneficial, and only because of the internet. The internet has amazing benefits. It also is terribly destructive. The amount of addiction, the amount of immodesty, the amount of pornography, and so on and so forth. Because the internet is scary. It's very, very scary and very, very dangerous. But it certainly doesn't mean I wouldn't be prepared to ban it because it's ineffective. And there's no reason if God created something and he didn't say it's treif, he might say some of the ways you use it is treif. But if it's not intrinsically treif, that means there's a way to use it and has a purpose, and we should use it for its purpose. It can actually be holy.
So I want to get to sort of how to practically apply what you just said, either in shul or I think at home also. I mean, if you're making a big, Simchas Torah meal at home or Purim meal at home, the same thing would apply. I just want to sort of reiterate Paul's question. I don't know if you actually touched on this thing specifically. Whose responsibility is it, or how are we going to ensure that children at shuls where alcohol is misused, get the right message or don't end up misusing it themselves?
So I think there's a few things I want to say about that. Number one is I think the discussion is a good discussion, and discussion has to be had. Or we shouldn't shy away from a discussion. And I think people should raise the issue and we should be discussing it, and shul should be discussing it, the community should be discussing it. It is a danger. There are teenagers that do misuse alcohol. That's a very, very, very dangerous thing. And I mean, it would be very, very sad if teenagers misuse alcohol, and also the message they get from the adults is the wrong message. So the discussion has to have. Ultimately, in every institution, it's up to the leadership, whether it's board, whether it's rabbis, whether it's influential balabatim, whatever the case is, to raise the alarm and to make sure. But I think the effective way of doing it is not to raise the alarm and say we have to ban alcohol, to raise the alarm and saying, what are we going to do so we can make sure that it's done properly, that the message is that we don't create a culture of alcohol, we don't create a culture of emptiness and just sort of a bar type partying culture, which, I mean, if someone wants to go to a bar for a bit of pleasure, I mean, I'm not, you know, that's his problem. But in shuls, we certainly shouldn't create such a culture, and it should be done properly and with depth and meaning and purpose. So ultimately, if a person lands up in an environment where that's not happening and they have no influence to stop it, they have to look for a different address. I mean, there's no shortcut there. But I think the stage one is to actually raise the discussion, talk about the discussion, makes suggestions, positive, constructive suggestions, not suggestions in the direction of banning, but in the suggestions in the direction of doing it properly.
So let's talk practically. So Paul just had an interesting comment here. I'm going to get to Gary's question in a moment. That ironically, negative alcohol behavior at shul resulted in a positive effect on my kids by seeing the danger of excess. By the way, I must say that's actually happened to me as well. I have seen alcohol being used well as a child. I've seen alcohol not being used well as a child, and there's no question about it that both had an unbelievable effect on me.
A very quick comment. That's very interesting. However, we know that it doesn't always happen that way, and in fact, I think most times it doesn't happen that way. And although seeing negative behavior often does inspire people to do the right thing, but it's a very risky strategy. So I would be advocating for good use of alcohol in schools and institutions and things like that.
Yeah, but it's an interesting comment.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
So Gary has a few questions, but I want to just mention one of them because in the context of what I was about to ask you, and we'll get to the rest afterwards, about how... Let's talk practically. You know, if you have a shul where alcohol or a home or whatever the scene where alcohol is going on hand, what are the practical steps a shul board can take, a shul rabbi can take to ensure that that alcohol is used in the right way?
So that's a good question.
He's asked, if you notice people are getting drunk at shul regularly, how do you deal with them? That's one question, but sort of more broader sense.
Okay, so I think people have to work together with the leadership of the shul. So let's say people notice that in any shul, again, I don't have any shul in mind now, so I'm just talking about generally, right? That people should talk to make a meeting with the rabbi, talk to the board, whatever the case is. And I think it means, number one, I think the rabbi of a shul or a board member of a shul or a president, whatever, has to get up and talk about it. And has to say, listen, we acknowledge that sometimes this can go the wrong way and we need to do something about it. And we prepare to bite the bullet and do something about it. And to send messages, I think, for example, right? For example, shuls that have fallen into the trap of having kiddush clubs, I would say, if the rabbi to get up and say, from today on, there is no kiddush clubs. Finished. It's over. Yeah, this shul doesn't support it. Doesn't condone it. We do not do it. We're not having it. Second of all, I was once in a shul overseas where the rabbi together with some of the board members, people there, thought that there was a problem. And they started a very interesting custom and actually had a tremendous effect. They started when they have the kiddush after shul, where people like to say l'chaim, they made the rabbi together with some board members, they got together and, you know, a team effort is always much more effective. And they made a thing where when they sit down to the kiddush after davening, they had a kiddush every Shabbos, and they said a little bit of l'chaim, but they made a thing that when they sit down to the kiddush, there's first the kiddush, no alcohol whatsoever. There's a dvar Torah. Then they bring out the l'chaim. Now it wasn't done in a way where, okay, we're gonna do the spiritual stuff first and then we're gonna party and go wild. What it actually did was it made the effect of the alcohol later much more positive because it created a focus, it created a context, and it moved away from the culture of alcohol, and it actually, I was there and actually I participated in it and actually allowed for actually a nice, meaningful fabrengen to take place afterwards, because it wasn't about grabbing the alcohol as soon as it comes in. It was about, let's stay focused, let's make kiddush, let's eat something, let's hear the Torah, and then we'll warm up a little bit. And that was the way it was done. It was amazing. So there are things that you can do. Number one, talking about what parents can do at home, talking about the messages, talking about the place of alcohol in Yiddishkeit, where it comes from. I mean, we just touched on it tonight, but there's much more. I mean, there's, you know, there's There's sometimes where it's a mitzvah to drink alcohol. There's a famous Gemara where, I mean, we spend another time going through the meaningless Gemara, but the mitzvah of Dalet Kois, the mitzvah of four cups of wine, is so important on Pesach night that the Gemara tells a story about Rabbi Yehuda, who's obviously allergic to wine. And nevertheless, it was such an important mitzvah that he would drink four cups of wine every Pesach night. And he had a headache until Shavuos. Right? You know,
that's longest recorded hangover in history.
Yeah, something like that, right? So, I mean, there's a lot to be discussed. There's a lot about wine, also about the whole, the mystical meaning of wine. I mean, there's a lot of depth in this concept of alcohol, the idea of the whole why we drink alcohol to begin with, the kiddush, why we make kiddush, we fix the sin of the. I mean, this is a good example, actually. I'll quickly go through it. One of the concepts of drinking wine on Friday night is to fix the sin of the first sin, the eating of the fruit of the Eitz Hadas, right? Of the fruit in Gan Eden. According to many, the fruit was a grape, right? And they ate a grape. And the plan originally was to make kiddush on that grape, on the wine from that grape on Shabbos. And then they messed it up. So what's the depth of this? The depth is because the wine that was going to be made from that grape was positive and had tremendous benefits. In fact, it symbolized the spiritual thing of revealing that which is hidden. But what happened was they prematurely used it for pleasure. It's exactly the point we're making. Mm. When you use it out of context, I had a kiddush club on Friday afternoon, right? And that's what happened. And that was the first. That's a good point. I had a kiddush club on the Friday afternoon, and that's exactly what happened. So these things need to be talked about. The discussion has to be had. Parents need to talk about to their children about why, for example, there's a certain age you shouldn't have alcohol because it's like driving a car. Driving a car is a very beneficial thing. But if you drive it too early, you will have a crash. You have to learn how to do it. It is a good thing, but nevertheless, it takes training. You have to be, it takes a certain maturity, takes a certain self-control. And generally, I want to say, generally, and this is true not only with alcohol, but it's true with everything. One of the greatest gifts we can give our children from a very, very young age, but not only a gift that we can give our children, a gift that we can display to our children, is the art of self-control. Delayed that gratification, right? As parents, for ourselves and for our families, we need to teach that. I mean, there's that famous marshmallow experiment, which I won't go through now, where they track people, kids who have more innate self-control and have a much more successful and effective life, right? You know, the temptation is a very strong thing. Having inbuilt from a very young age the art of self-control is a very, very beneficial thing. And when we do use things in a proper way, one of the ways we do it is by self-control. Right, we don't, you know, it's interesting that whenever we have a yontif like Purim or Simchas Torah, whenever we have a yontif or a wedding, whenever we have a yontif where there's going to be a lot of happiness, including saying l'chaim, where the happiness can go either way, it can become very meaningful or it can become wild and empty, it's always preceded by something very serious. You realize that? Purim has a fast the day before. Simchas Torah comes after Yom Kippur. Sukkot Simchas Torah comes after Yom Kippur. A wedding is preceded by a fast of the chasen and kala and a very solemn ceremony at the chuppah, because you need a focus, you need a content, you need to hold back first. And that's the kind of messages and the kind of discussions we should be having. Rather than banning it all, we should be having discussions how to channel it in the correct way.
I will just add, more of a practical admin level. That's part of my job. When it comes to alcohol in times like Simchas Torah and Purim and things like that, I think just on a very, very practical level, one of the ways you know, there's sort of two parts to this, like everything, is what we call sur meira nase tov. It's like, you know, staying away from bad and then there's doing it good. So doing it well, we've discussed, it needs to be done with focus, etc. But in order to create that atmosphere, you need the staying away from bad type of thing, right? In other words, you need to make sure that no one gets drunk and no one gets out of hand in order to create that positive atmosphere. I think it's a very practical thing. You know, if you have a Purim Simchas Torah and you put out 10 bottles of alcohol on the table and no one's in control of who's taking it and where is it going, that's a recipe for a disaster. You know, I know that at Bina we have a thing. There's only one bottle at a time out. And that bottle is held by one known person who's in charge. And I've had times on Purim where people have fallen in and they were clearly... They weren't at Bina the whole time. That may be the problem. they came from somewhere else, and they and they were totally intoxicated, and I refused to give them. I had to, you know, I didn't give them, and that's it. And then they walked out, and that was the end of it. And I think that if every place had that, you know, it's, in order to create that positive focus, in order to do it right, we need to make sure to negate any negative ways of doing it, and that needs control. It needs someone
setting up for success.
Needs someone to be in charge. Needs someone to really take control and be strong and sort of be in charge. Someone had a very interesting question here, which I'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to know what your answer is. I know people only go to shul for a l'chaim. Is it better that they come to shul or not have a l'chaim? Or I guess the question is it better they come to shul and have the l'chaim, or not come to shul and not have l'chaim?
It's a very interesting question. So a solution has to be found. If that's the only way a person comes to shul, it still can be structured in a way where the l'chaim is given in a positive context. Now, it is true that some, you know, in terms of outreach, there might be people whose shul is not meaningful for them, and the l'chaim they have at the kiddush at least gives them a positive experience. But still, what type of l'chaim is it? In other words, if a person says, I'm going to go to shul because of the l'chaim, and the l'chaim that we talk about them having in shul is in a similar atmosphere and culture as the l'chaim they would have in a bar, then didn't accomplish anything by coming to shul. It's just that they found the kosher bar. Understand? But if someone, let's say, you know, they have an expression in America, JFK, when a person comes to Kiddush, JFK, just for Kiddush, right? I wouldn't throw someone out of shul for that. But if the l'chaim that they're able to get in shul is, from the shul's point of view, done right, in other words, it's not a Kiddush club, it's after davening, it's at the Kiddush, it's in moderation, it's under control, comes together with a bit of meaning and purpose, a bit of a discussion, a nigun, a dance, a bar Torah, a fabring, whatever the case is. And that person comes for that and lives for that. That's where they're out of the journey. Okay, maybe eventually they'll be drawn in, they'll see the beauty, and I'll start davening a little bit also. But not if it's just going to look like the regular bar and that's why they come. I don't think that serves any purpose. In other words, a shul is not a social club. There might be a room for social clubs in a positive way, but that's not a shul. And it sends the wrong message to other people. It's dangerous for other people, particularly children.
Mm. Talking about children, I mean, you touched on it briefly, and I know it's not really the topic of tonight at all. Maybe you can just spend 1 or 2 minutes about children and alcohol. You know, can children make kiddush? Could is there any place at all to give children alcohol? Is that ever a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Should it be?
First of all, it's illegal. But it's unlegal drinking. Now, I mean, you know what's interesting? And if anyone's ever noticed this, Judaism gives children alcohol at the youngest age. Have you ever noticed that by bris we actually give a child alcohol? Do you know that? No, specifically so. First of all, some moyolim do this. They calm down the kid by giving them a little bit of the wine. But actually, part of the ceremony of a bris is to actually dip the finger twice in the kiddushka, in the wine. And when we say v'omer loch b'demai chayi twice, and we actually put it into the child's mouth. So again, I when I was a child, and my father was makbid, he was he was careful to make kiddush only on wine, not grape juice, which is where many people are. It went around the table, and children had a sip. I mean, you know, but it was nothing more than that. On the other hand, it was a very clear message. Although my father said l'chaim sometimes, but when we were kids, we didn't get any. It was once in a while when we went to make a jog, he said, "I'll give you some l'chaim." He used to like pour a drop into a cup and then fill it up with water. No, I don't think so. But I don't think we should hide alcohol from children either. What I mean to say is that when children sit at a table, I mean, you grew up, and we said l'chaim, and we had fabrangans at home, and we did all these things, right? And I think you turned out semi okay. And I think the reason is because it's good for children to see. It's nothing wrong, put it this way. Nothing wrong. Children shouldn't have alcohol themselves. It's too dangerous. But it needs to be of age, and we need to be legal anyways. But I do think that when children grow up and they see alcohol being used properly, to say l'chaim, to give someone a bracha, to have a fabring in a meaningful way, to be focused, in control, and so on and so forth, as we've been speaking the whole time, I don't think it has a negative effect. I think it has a positive effect. I think it actually teaches them how to do it right when they grow up.
Mm. If anyone has any other questions, please feel free to ask. Let's just end off with just to get your thoughts on the following question. You know, you described alcohol as quite a lofty thing in a way, actually. You know, if it's used properly, it can really, you know, inspire people and to grow in the Yiddishkeit. As I mentioned, from my experience, I've watched very, very, very great people say L'chaim, and that's actually really shaped me. I mean, the things that they told me, and you know, I had a mashpia in yeshiva when I was in Israel. From time to time, he used to have a fabring and he say L'chaim, he used to give it to me, but in a good way. In other words, he used to tell, you know, why aren't you doing this better? Because it was only possible because we, you know, he had said L'chaim. If it's such a powerful thing, why is it also such a destructive thing? Why do we find something which could be used in such a powerful way could also be used in such a destructive way?
That's a great question. So I think the best way to answer that is to quote to you what the Gemara says. An amazing thing. We know that we are people of the book, right? One of the greatest treasures, one of the greatest gifts that we have, were given ever, is the Torah. The study of Torah, right? Eis chayim ilam machazikibo, we refer to the Torah as a tree of life. If we learn Torah, we're connected to the tree of life, to eternity, to spirituality, to divinity, and so on and so forth. Yet the Talmud says an amazing line. The Talmud says that when a person learns Torah, it is like a potion. It's like an ointment. If you merit, if you do it the right way, it becomes the potion of life. If you misuse it, the very same Torah can become poisonous. That's what it says. Because we are taught that in this world, the world where God is hidden, and this is something explained in Hasidus and in mysticism, that ever since the sin of the tree, good and bad is all mixed together. And in this world where God is much more hidden than in the supernal worlds, everything has the potential to be used for good and for bad. The best analogy, I think, is the more good something can be used for, the more bad it can be used for also. Electricity is an amazing invention. You can have a machine. The higher the voltage of the machine, the higher the power of the machine, the more it can build, the more it can construct, the more it can benefit society, but also the more dangerous it is, right? If there's a work accident with a little plug-in, a little tiny knife, you get a cut, you get some stitches, and you're okay. If it's with a very, very powerful machine that's needed to build a very, very strong building, it can also be very, very deadly if it's misused and not used with the proper safety precautions. That's why it works on the contrary. Sometimes it goes all the way around. The more destructive something is, you can see the more powerful it can be if it's used in the right way. So that's part of the training as being a Jew, to learn to how to do things, learning how to use things for the benefit rather than for the detriment.
Yeah, and I think also just sort of to end off, a clarification. I don't think we're sort of saying here that everyone has to say L'chaim or it's
no.
Everyone has to know themselves, and you know, if it does good things for you, then good. If it doesn't do good things for you, then it's also fine. You know, then don't do it. Hashem should help that we should be guided in the right way with this. It's obviously sort of a tricky, nuanced, complicated discussion. I hope you all enjoyed. Please God, next week we'll continue. Next week we're going to have a discussion. It's perhaps a little bit connected, but it's a much more broader discussion about a rabbi's role on a personal level, how you've done this in balancing being popular, attracting people, and standing up for the right things at the same time, even when that means maybe offending people or people not liking you as a result. How do you balance those two things? So that's going to be a fascinating discussion next week, same time, same link. Until then, have a wonderful week, everyone.
All the best, everyone.